Good morning, everyone. We are speaking to you from the National Press Club Auditorium in Washington, where this morning there is a meeting of the American Society of Newspaper Editors. Mr. Webb Miller, European Manager of the United Press, is to address those gathered here on the subject of the situation in Spain. Mr. Miller will be introduced by Mr. Marvin H. Krager, Managing Editor of the Milwaukee Journal and President of the American Society of Newspaper Editors. Mr. Krager.
Thank you. Members of the American Society of Newspaper Editors and of the radio audience, I introduce Webb Miller, distinguished world correspondent for the United Press and author. Mr. Miller, who came from Europe especially for this meeting, brings a trained observer's story of the bloody days in Spain. Mr. Miller.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am on the spot up here today. Hugh Bailey, president of the United Press, brought me from Europe for the sole and specific purpose of making this speech. When he saw my expense account, he said, "This speech better be good." But I have nothing pleasant or agreeable to tell you. I am to speak of Spain, and it is a story of blood, tears, and terror. What I am to say is based upon a couple of months with General Franco's army. Also, I've talked with a score of neutral foreign correspondents who've emerged from Spain recently. In the few days since I landed in America, first thing everyone asks is, what is going to happen in Spain? Who is going to win? When will it end? So I may as well commence with those questions. Of course, I don't know the answer, or does anybody else. However, an experienced airplane pilot without instruments can tell you pretty accurately how far above the ground he is. But he cannot tell you for the life of him how he arrived at the figure. Similarly, an experienced correspondent can often arrive somewhere in the vicinity of the truth of an imponderable situation without knowing just how he arrived. So I'm going to give you my guesses. I believe that the war will eventually end through exhaustion and collapse of morale of one of the other sides, rather than by definite victory of arms. I do not believe that either side can score a knockout punch. This war has again demonstrated that when the opposing armies are anywhere nearly evenly matched in strength, the defense is relatively so strong compared with offensive power that a decisive blow cannot be struck, and the result comes by attrition and exhaustion. There are so many unforeseeable factors that I would hesitate to predict which side will collapse first. But I should not much be surprised if the war were still going on this autumn, or even later. The passions aroused are so bitter, and the issues are so fundamental, that I believe there can be no question of termination of the war by compromise or negotiation. In the last 21 years, I have seen something of six wars, but none, not even the World War, is so ghastly and horrible. In Spain, you have three wars rolled into one. It is a political war, an economic war, and has elements of a religious war. These elements deeply stir some of the fundamental wellsprings of human passion. The result is a war of unparalleled ferocity. In some ways, it resembles the ancient religious wars in which it was an act of piety for a Christian to kill an infidel or vice versa. And never in modern times has there been such a holocaust of cold-blooded slaughter, of prisoners, of wounded, and of helpless hostages by tens of thousands. One of Franco's officers said to me, "We are fighting an idea. The idea is in the brain, and to kill the idea, you have to kill the man. We must kill everyone who has that idea." One of the sickening phases of the Spanish War is the wide development of the use of terrorism as a definite weapon, just like bullets, shells, starvation, propaganda. The terrorism of civilian populations by indiscriminate bombing from the air has largely wiped out the old distinctions between combatants and non-combatants. Among the dead and wounded on both sides are many thousands of women and children. When I was in Oviedo, a town of 70,000 people, incidentally, I'm only one of only two American correspondents who've ever been into Oviedo yet. It's a town of 70,000, and had been completely surrounded and closely besieged at that time for 90 days. And I often saw children running around the streets wearing bandages from wounds from bombs. And the kids even had a game they called bombing, which they played in the streets. The boy lay on the ground while his companion held a brick above him and then dropped it. And the excitement of the game lay in rolling over before the brick bat hit him. In the months of constant fighting around and in the town, the children had become accustomed to war and accepted it as part of their normal life. I watched children romping and playing in the little park, heedless of heavy rifle fire going on half a mile away. In the 3 months of the siege, there had been more than 100 air raids at that time. In a single day, 1,910 bombs were dropped. Up to the time I was there, 600 non-combatants, including hundreds of women and children, had been killed in Oviedo. I'd been in Spain only a few hours when I caught my first glimpse of one of the innumerable horrors of the Civil War. It was in the squalid little mountain village called La Parra. While the village guard of four wrinkled peasants, armed with shotguns, whose only uniform consisted of a white band around their left arm, were examining our papers, I noticed a motor truck nearby loaded with crudely made black pine coffins. On top of the coffin sat four bareheaded peasant women dressed in shabby black garments. The strange expression of mingled horror and grief and determination on their weather-beaten faces attracted my attention. Then I noticed two men standing on the ground, apparently pleading with them to come down. They argued earnestly while the women shook their heads. We questioned them, and one said, "When the Rojos evacuated this village about 2 weeks ago, they took as hostages 25 of the principal men of the village who were suspected of sympathies with Franco. We heard no more of them until 2 days ago. Then a shepherd up in the turpentine forest stumbled upon their bodies. All of the 25 had been mowed down by machine guns. Their hands were bound together with wire. Their bodies lay in heaps just as they'd fallen. Wild animals and vultures had eaten the bodies, and they were in a horrible condition. We made some coffins, and we're going up there to gather the bodies and bury them. And these women are widows of four of them, and they want to go see the bodies of their men. We don't want them to, because it's too horrible for them to see." This is only one of literally thousands of nauseating horrors that have occurred on both sides. About 2 hours after leaving that village, we reached the edge of the war zone on the Toledo front. And just outside Talavera, a sickening stench filled the air. In the ditches lay crumpled figures in twos and threes, dressed in coarse blue denim overalls, the decomposed bodies of government militia killed in the fighting a couple of weeks before. Their faces had turned black. Beyond Talavera, we came upon the battlefield where the Madrid government had made its most determined stand to halt the drive upon Toledo. There, huddled bodies lay in the grotesque postures in which they had fallen. They dotted the fields on either side of the road. Their bloated bodies of horses strewed the roadside. Some lay partway across the roads with their entrails spilled out. And here and there, bodies of men sprawled partly in the road. No one had bothered to even drag them out. And we turned our automobile around them and went on. One scene I shall never forget. An armored car stood on the edge of the road with eight dead militiamen in and around the car. It had broken down in the thick of the fighting. The occupants had tried to escape, but were trapped by Moors lying in the ditches. As the crew started to leave the machine, the Moors flung hand grenades and killed them all instantly. Death had caught and arrested them in motion, just as though a film had suddenly stopped, and the bodies were stiffened in the exact postures of the last movement. The driver still had one hand on the wheel, and had managed to get a leg out of the car when he was struck dead. The expression of fear and horror contorted his face. Another man was halfway out of the other door, and six others were crumpled around the car. In the week that followed, we passed this scene twice a day, 4 days on our way to and from the front. Finally, gangs of peasants were put to work gathering up the 300 or 400 bodies which dotted the fields around here like collapsed sacks, piled them in heaps, poured gasoline on them and burned them. In the space of a mile near the armored car, I saw 6 large piles of ashes, one pile about 4 feet high. Undoubtedly, the 70-day siege of the Alcazar in Toledo and its relief attracted more attention to America than any one incident in the war. I covered the last phases of Franco's drive upon Toledo and entered the Toledo and the Alcazar with General Franco. As we entered the town on midday, September 29th, columns of thick smoke arose from burning buildings. San Juan Hospital, just outside the city, was burning fiercely, and the smoke bore the stench of burning flesh. There was much mystery about exactly what happened at San Juan Hospital, but the fact remains that several hundred wounded men were burned to death there. We entered through the famous, well-named gate called the Gate of Blood. And inside the gate lay crumpled bodies covered with dust thrown up by the passing trucks. Other bodies with hands wired together lay in a jumble at the foot of a parapet, apparently having been tossed there after execution. And the principal square beside the Alcazar was littered with debris interspersed with dead horses and mules. Here and there, huge blobs of blood reddened the pavement, sometimes with a militiaman's cap in it. And stumbling in single file behind General Franco, we clambered over this vast hillock of broken rubble, which had been the northern end of the Alcazar. Up in the courtyard, there are hundreds of gaunt, bearded men, their dazed eyes staring vacantly, their faces the color of old parchment, their hair and beards matted with dust, the pulverized stone, set up a wavering cheer. Emaciated women in dresses stiff with dirt, and listless, half-starved children stared, and the stink of unwashed bodies and worse filled the air. Franco embraced Moscardo, the commander of the Alcazar, and then spoke to the survivors. Moscardo, a tall, stooped man with his uniform caked with dirt, stood with tears running down his unkempt beard. Then, after the ceremony, we picked our way through the debris, which was strewn with priceless books from the library and covered with blood. There was one painting of a general hanging about 10 feet up on the wall, had a great fresh splash of blood right across his face. Then we went down in the tunnel below where 1,670 men, women, and children had lived for 70 days. A scene like an illustration for Dante's Inferno. There was almost no ventilation. The light was only candles made of mule fat, and the atmosphere almost gagged you. Just through the window outside, I looked through and saw a pile of 50 to 60 bodies, one on top of the other. I tried to count them, got up to about 50, but you couldn't count them because they overlay one another so thickly. We walked around among the people who were still in there. Remember, there were 520 women, 50 children, besides the men combatants. And they lay, most of the women lay on pallets on the floor, old piles of old uniform, burlap, and mattresses. The women, many of them who couldn't get up, held these wailing children in their arms who were frightened by our incursion in here. Everybody in this nightmarish dungeon was the color of mushrooms grown in dark places.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard an address by Mr. Webb Miller, European manager of the United Press, addressing a gathering here of the American Society of Newspaper Editors on the subject, the situation in Spain. He was introduced by Mr. Marvin H. Krager, managing editor of the Milwaukee Journal and president of the American Society of Newspaper Editors. This program has come to you from Washington, a Red Network presentation of the National Broadcasting Company.